I realize that if you have been sitting in my Sunday morning class, I realize we've been dealing a lot with David and his Psalms and his life and his things that he went through. And I realize we may be bordering on obsessing about it. And I'm going to try to move on here pretty soon. But there's a good lesson I read in a book I've been looking at. And it's talking about why David was called a man after God's own heart. And so I wanted to deal a little bit with this morning. And I think that as a justification, if I need one, for dealing a lot with David in the Psalms, is that, you know, there's nobody else in the Bible that's probably more studied and well recorded than David. He had more words and chapters dedicated to his life than any other character in the Old Testament. He's probably second behind Jesus Christ as far as being more said about an individual than anybody else. There's all the Psalms that we have, 150 Psalms. Of course, he didn't write all of them, but a big majority of them he wrote. We have songs that we sing today inspired by his great writing. So there's so much about him recorded in the Bible. I think that it must be important. It must be something that God wanted us to look at and wanted us to look at his character and his life and take lessons from it. And so that's what we're going to do this morning, briefly. A little snapshot about why he was called a man after God's own heart and what that means to us as Christians. We know that he did not have any particularly unusual physical attractiveness, other than he was a handsome young man. That's all that is really recorded. It's mentioned a couple of times. Samuel recorded for us that he was ruddy with beautiful eyes and a handsome appearance. And that's it. That's about all that's mentioned about David as far as his looks. And yet, when he was still a boy, shepherding his own flock, or his father's flock, God basically said, "You are it. You are what I'm looking for, and you are the future king of Israel." And we also know he said, "You are going to be an ancestor to Jesus Christ." You know, even David's father did not think there was anything especially special about his youngest son, David. You know, you may remember the account that Samuel recorded about where he was told to go out and anoint the future king of Israel. And he told Jesse to bring all his boys through, and he was going to look at them, and God was going to tell him which one was the one. And he gets to the end of the line, and Samuel says, "Is this all of your family? Is this all your children?" And Jesse's like, "Oh, well, yeah, I guess we got the youngest one. He's out with the sheep." He'd almost forgot about him, hadn't he? Or he had forgot about him. And so Samuel calls him and says, "Well, go get him." And sure enough, that's the one that God says, "This is the one you need to anoint as the future king of Israel." You remember there, if you remember this time in history, it was a pivotal time, a tumultuous time. They had kind of moved out of the time of the judges. They were kind of towards the end of that, we could say. And it was one of those times that Israel was beginning to drift away from God, one of many times they drifted. And the people there in this time period probably remembered some of the time of the mighty judges. They probably had been taught and told about, you know, Samson and Deborah and all these great judges, Gideon. And they could see things were still not going well in their society. And even they couldn't even hardly look to Samuel. Samuel was becoming an old man. He was nearing the end of his life. And even his sons could not be counted on. They were not honest. They were dishonest. They were taking bribes. They were perverting justice, it says, in 1 Samuel 8:1-3, if you want to just look at that. So you can imagine how low the morale of the people was at this time. You know, nothing disillusions people more than hypocritical and corrupt leadership. Isn't that what happens? When we see our leaders that are corrupt and dishonest and perverting justice, it becomes a very disillusioning thing as far as a nation. It doesn't matter if it's national politics or state or local politics or school boards or even the church, when there's political corruption, when there's dishonest leaders, people become discouraged and society begins to decline. You can see it happen even in the church when leadership becomes corrupt. So people come to Samuel and ask for a king. They say, "We need a king because your sons are not doing a good job and all the other nations have kings. And so we want one too." They want to keep up with the Joneses, so to speak. Now that's a popular, or it's a common weakness to want what is popular, right? It's our human nature. We want to be associated with what's popular oftentimes. It's kind of in our nature to want that. Instinctively, we don't necessarily want to stand out in the crowd. We don't want to be different. And the people here in Israel wanted to be like all their neighbors. So what do they do? You know the account if you study this. They go and they pick the most handsome man in the land. The one that reads the teleprompter so well and has a deep bass voice. The one that is head and shoulders above everybody else. That's what people do. That's what we do. When we pick our own leaders, we tend to pick based on popularity and looks. You know, it's been well studied and well documented and well understood and believed by many people that the election of 1960 was based on looks. If John F. Kennedy was not so much better looking than Richard Nixon, Richard Nixon probably would have won the election, because in the debates on the radio, Richard Nixon consistently scored better. And in that one televised debate, everybody thought that John F. Kennedy did better because he looked better on TV. That's the way people are. We're influenced by people's looks. Sometimes we don't even consider people's character. That's what happened with Saul. They didn't consider his character. They saw somebody who was powerful, a warrior, a good military leader. He stood a head above everybody else. He was a tall man. And that's who they picked. Saul turns out, of course, to not be a great leader, especially after he'd been in a couple of decades. If people were disillusioned before, they were certainly disillusioned at the end of Saul's kingdom also. Because what's worse than realizing the decision that you made is the wrong one? It has caused everything to go wrong. Isn't that just a blow when you have made a decision and everything goes wrong because of that decision? It really strikes at the heart. So that's probably what we can say that might have happened to the people of Israel. 1 Samuel 13, Samuel sums up very succinctly Saul's kingdom and what had happened. 1 Samuel 13, starting at verse 13. Samuel replied to Saul, "You have acted foolishly. Had you kept the command the Lord your God gave you, the Lord would now establish your kingship in Israel forever. But now your kingship shall not endure. Because," what does he say? "The Lord has sought out a man after his own heart," implying that Saul's heart was not after God's heart. "The Lord has sought out a man after his own heart to appoint as ruler over his people, because you did not observe what the Lord commanded you." When you think about how much of the Bible, as I mentioned, is dedicated to David's life, his legacy, his writings, and how he is specifically mentioned a couple of different times in the Bible as a man after God's own heart, you begin to think he's some kind of superhero. So we don't want to get the wrong idea about why God chose him and why he chooses anybody. That's what I want to look at today. Why he picked him and what he looks for. The qualities God is looking for in his service. Because none of us are perfect and none of us are spiritual superheroes. And David wasn't either. David was not a perfect man. We realize that. But he had a heart that was after God's own heart. Remember, even today, Paul reemphasizes this, that we're not picked because of our special abilities necessarily. 1 Corinthians chapter 1. I'm going to read 26 through 30. I don't have it all on the screen, but I'm going to read all of it. 26 through 30. "For consider your calling, brethren, that there are not that there were not many wise according to the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble. But God has chosen the foolish things of the world to shame the wise, and God has chosen the weak things of the world to shame the things which are strong. And the base things of the world and the despised God has chosen, the things that are not, so that He may nullify the things that are, so that no man may boast before God. But by His doing you are in Christ Jesus. Not many. Paul's telling the Corinthians, here, look around. Look around in the Corinthian church. You won't find anybody that is especially impressive around here. Nobody that's especially well educated or mighty or that are of nobility. And why? God has chosen you, normal people, everyday people, so that He can be the one to lift us up, and so that nobody could boast, so nobody could brag, like Saul could have bragged. Well, I'm a mighty warrior. Look at all the things I've done. Society, again, tends to elevate the highly educated, the physically strong, the talented. Just like Israel picked Saul for their king, we do the same today. We tend to focus on the superficial stuff that gives us reasons to boast. And that's not the way God works. God picks nobodies to turn them into somebodies. When God searches for somebody for His purposes, He doesn't look for angels in the flesh. He is not looking for perfect people. And because, here's a newsflash, there aren't any. The first quality He looks for in His people is those that are spiritual. He looks for those with a level of spirituality. He's looking for somebody after His own heart. God is spirit, and He wants somebody that is in harmony with Him. So what does it mean to be spiritual and in harmony with God? Well, what is important to Him is important to you. If He wants you to go one way, you go that way. He wants you to stop doing something, you stop. When you are spiritual, you have a heart that is sensitive to the things of God. Just like if you have a spiritual connection with your spouse, you go where they want to go. You go do things they like. You want to do things that they want to do. You have a spiritual connection. That's what God is looking for. 2 Chronicles 16, verse 9. For the eyes of the Lord move to and fro throughout the earth, that He may strongly support those whose heart is completely His. He wants disciples that are completely and totally His. He wants those whose hearts have no division in their dedication to Him. What did Jesus say about serving God and man? You can't do it. You have to pick one or the other. Being spiritually minded, a heart after God's own heart, you will admit when you're wrong and have done something contrary to His will. You're concerned about what displeases Him, and you want to please Him because your heart belongs totally to Him. When God told Samuel He had already picked someone to be the next king of Israel, as a spiritual being, He had already been around Jesse's family and his boys. He had already been, looking around, so to speak, in this region. And He already knew, because He's all-knowing, He already knew that David had the right kind of heart, even when he was a young man. He had already seen into the heart of David and knew David was totally dedicated to Him. God didn't want somebody slick and handsome and physically impressive. He wanted somebody with humility and character, good character. He knew David was authentic. He knew he wasn't somebody that was just faking their spirituality. He knew that David was somebody that would do as commanded without grumbling or complaining and is happy to be a servant. That's what he saw in David. While David and David's brothers were off fighting an important battle, and they thought they were doing something really important, and it was something important, he was back at home quietly tending the sheep. Psalm 78:70. He also chose David, his servant, and took him from the sheepfolds. From the care of the ewes with suckling lambs, he brought him to shepherd Jacob, his people, and Israel, his inheritance. So he shepherded them according to the integrity of his heart and guided them with his skillful hands. Notice the word there, integrity. Soundness. Solid. A good foundation has integrity. Something that's not changed or manipulated. Integrity is very important to God. Complete, whole, innocent, wholesome, sound, unimpaired are some synonyms. All those things that are important when it comes to doing right. Knowing you are doing the right thing all the way to your very core. Knowing that you're doing the right thing. So, how does God train those ordinary, not noble, not mighty people that He finds that have the kind of heart, the kind of character He is looking for? How does He build them into mighty specimens of servants that are eager to do His will? Well, we'll look at David's case. He trained him in solitude. You know, he had to learn life's lessons alone before he could be trusted with greater responsibility. You know, he quietly tended his father's flock alone on the Judean hillsides, facing the challenges and responsibility of making his own decisions. Can you imagine being, say, a young teenager, and you send him out to the hillsides to just take care of the flock? If any bears or lions come along, you got to do something about it. What are you going to do? You don't have a gun. What are you going to do? He had to figure out these things on his own. He had to plan his own meals. He had to plan ahead for his meals. He had to set his own schedule. And he had to contemplate things about God alone. You know, it's kind of like one of the ways I kind of tried to illustrate it, think of it in my mind, is like when you send kids off to college, they have to kind of learn to be on their own, don't they? And not all the learning is in the classroom, is it? You know, you go from high school where teachers are constantly reminding you that an assignment is due, how are you coming along on that project, you know, we need to finish this, blah, 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 to end up with professors that tell you this is due at the end of the semester and they're not going to tell you again. You just have to remember. You have to, you know, take care of your clothes, you have to take care of your car, you know, this learning to live life alone. You have to learn to be independent. So that's kind of the way we think of it today. There comes a point that you can't depend on others. You can't depend on parents or grandparents or your heritage or your whatever, your background in your spirituality. You have to be able to do it on your own. You have to be able to explain your faith on your own to yourself and to those around you. Think of the solitude that David experienced as a shepherd. Kind of got a picture here in the background of the shepherd with the sheep. The green pastures, the still waters. Oh, he wrote about that, didn't he? He wrote about that solitude. I think that was one of the things that God used to help David develop his mind when he was alone shepherding the flock. Second, God often trains people in obscurity. You know, those that are born famous, have you noticed? Those that are born famous often do not have the depth and the skills and the ability to live lives responsibly. You know, they haven't learned, you know, they've been in the limelight from the very beginning of their lives, and when they don't know how to handle life a lot of times. Servant leaders of God in the making are often unknown, unseen, unappreciated, and unapplauded. Obscurity is where character is built. You know what character is? Good character is doing the right thing when you know it won't be noticed. It may seem strange, but those trained and those that develop in obscurity will develop the humility that they need when it comes time to handle the popularity that may come later. Never really thought about that. You know, when you live in obscurity for years and you learn how to be humble, that better prepares you for popularity and praise that may come later. The third way that God trains His servant leaders is monotony. How does this train us for anything? It's important to learn how to deal with the daily grind of life, isn't it? Kind of like we alluded to on solitude, learning how to do the menial, insignificant, routine, regular, uneventful activities of daily life and do it faithfully. Now they say in commercial aviation, being a commercial pilot is filled with hours and hours and hours of monotony, interrupted by a few seconds of sheer panic. Well, David had to train in monotony day after day, tending the flock, preparing meals, reporting back to his father. Those little tasks in life that seemed like drudgery, but those very ordinary tasks that seemed so insignificant would become very important if somebody stopped doing it, right? Can you imagine if somebody stopped cleaning this building? How long would it take for everybody to start complaining about how dirty it was? If the city stopped patching the cracks in the road, how long before the roads all fall apart? If you stopped mowing the grass, weeds around the house, how long before they get out of hand? Not very long. With nobody noticing and doing a job that nobody else cares about, God still notices, doesn't He? And He knows how you feel about it. So instead of doing those little insignificant jobs grudgingly, remember who we are serving. So David had to do these little insignificant daily jobs that trained him for adulthood and did it without complaining, without being grudgingly, and it better trained him for leadership. The fourth training area is dealing with reality. With all the talk of solitude, obscurity, and monotony, you might think that David was just sitting out there on the hillside in a haze of daydreams and musical interludes and writing poetry. That wasn't the case, was it? He had to deal with reality too. We've read it before several times. Think about David's retelling of his match with the bear and the lion. 1 Samuel 17, 34-35. But David said to Saul, "Your servant was tending his father's sheep," probably in solitude, obscurity, monotony, tending the sheep, "when a lion or a bear came and took a lamb from the flock. I went out after him and attacked him and rescued it from his mouth. And when he rose up against me, I seized him by his beard and struck him and killed him." There's reality. That sounds a little bit like commercial aviation, doesn't it? The preparation and the quiet times where he was contemplating God's presence strengthened him for the times when reality struck. When Goliath challenged the army, it was just another challenge he was prepared for. This is another example that God is not going to take care of everything for you. We don't want to teach that false doctrine that if we have enough faith, God will fix all our problems. You know, all things work out for good for those that love the Lord. But people kind of misapply that and apply it to mean, well, everything's going to turn out good for us if we have enough faith. That's not what that's saying. God gives us the tools, but it's still up to us to fix the flat. Sometimes we make the wrong decisions. Sometimes people around us make wrong decisions, and we have to deal with the consequences. God is not going to be the bumpers on the bowling alley of life. David had to go out and meet that wild animal in hand-to-hand combat, so to speak, or that lamb would have been lost. I don't know how much David realized he was training for the monarchy, but all this time when he was quietly working through life, he was preparing for something bigger. It's in these little things and in the lonely parts of life where we prove ourselves capable of the bigger things. If you want to accomplish great things, you need to cultivate your skills doing the little things well. The test of our Christianity, here's an important point. The test of our Christianity is not the big things of how well we worship on Sunday. It's how well does our character guide us Monday through Saturday when nobody is there to check up on us. When nobody will notice if we neglect the things that we should be doing. That's the real test of our Christianity. And secondly, we need to remember that when God develops our inner qualities, He is never in a hurry. The conversion of a soul happens in the instant of obedience and baptism and repentance. But the forming of a saint is the task of a lifetime. It's in the schoolroom of solitude and obscurity we learn to become men and women of God. It's the schoolmasters of monotony that teach us to have the qualities of future kings. And that's how we can learn to become like David, men and women after God's own heart. So I hope you were able to take some lessons from this morning. I hope it will encourage you to do those daily tasks every day to please God, to bring glory to God, remembering that He is noticing what we're doing each day and that we're living up to the best ability we have. So if you have any need this morning, would you come as we stand and sing?